answer the court through modi cations. This is the context for the Garland collision. Yes, McConnell broke with past practice in refusing to even consider quali-ed Democratic candidates. But he was operating in an era when the Supreme Court had become a more partisan institution, rendering more partisan decisions on more partisan cases. The idea that nominees should be judged on professional merit rather than philosophical alignment had long since ceased to reset the real workings of the system. There is perhaps no single vote members of the U.S. Senate take with as much long-term ideological importance than that of a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court, and asking them to keep that vote, and that vote alone, separate from the ideological promises they make to their voters, and to themselves, is bizarre. This is a problem that exists much in American governance. The rules, as set down in the Constitution and our institutions, push toward partisan dysfunction, conflict, and even collapse. The system works not through formal mechanisms that ensure the settlement of intractable disputes, but through informal norms of compromise, forbearance, and moderation that collapse the moment the stakes rise high enough. McConnell didn't break any laws or devise any new powers to stop Garland, he just led his party to break with the historical practice of appointing Supreme Court justices they didn't agree with ideologically, a historical practice that forces parties to regularly cross their ideologies and voters for the good of the system. In breaking with that precedent, he was doing precisely what his voters wanted, and they rewarded him for it in the next election. Why should any of his successors do anything different? But now imagine a world where Republicans, due to their advantages in small states, routinely hold the Senate while Democrats, who've won the popular vote in 6 of the last 7 presidential elections, routinely hold the White House. What happens to the Supreme Court in that world? Do vacancies just go unfilled? What if Democrats then come to see the Supreme Court as fundamentally illegitimate, as its conservative majority relies on Republicans refusing to consider Democratic nominees? Do Democrats continue abiding by its rulings? As Linz argued, a presidential political system in which power is divided among different branches works when the parties that control those branches are ideologically mixed enough to cooperate with one another, and that was, for much of the 20th century, the secret to the American political system's success. But now America's political parties are ideologically polarized. They are also, importantly, nationalized. All politics isn't local. Nebraska Senator Ben Nelson was the NAL, crucial vote on the Affordable Care Act. Nelson was an old-school Democratic centrist, a transactional, silver-haired former insurance executive who held on in a red state through acts of ostentatious moderation and a laser-like focus on Cornhusker interests. But he was in a bind. The choice on Obamacare was yes/no. Democrats needed his vote to pass the law. Nelson wanted the law to pass. But Obamacare was unpopular back home, and Nelson was up for re-election in 2012. He was caught between his career, his party, and his conscience. Nelson's solution was to split the ideological interests of Nebraska's Republicans from the financial interests of Nebraskans. Obamacare's Medicaid expansion was built with an unusual structure. Typically, Medicaid is funded by a roughly 60-40 split between the federal government and the states. The Affordable Care Act, however, promised that the federal government would pay 100% of the law's new Medicaid costs for 3 years, before phasing down to a 90-10 split by 2020. But some conservatives said that even the 10% states were being asked to pay was too much. This was, in particular, a charge levied by Nebraska's popular Republican governor, Dave Heineman. So Nelson negotiated a special deal on the state's behalf. For Nebraska, the federal government would carry 100% of the Medicaid expansion's bill, a subsidy worth more than $100 million. Nelson was doing what members of Congress have done since the dawn of the Republic, winning support for a polarizing national policy by extracting a material concession for his state. The American political system is built on a deep sense of place. The House isn't meant to host the meeting of two parties but of 435 districts. The Senate is not meant to represent red and blue but to balance the interests of FTY states. This re-echoes the founders' belief true in their time that our political identities were rooted in our cities and states, not the more abstract bonds of nationhood. Many considerations seem to place it beyond doubt that the RST and most natural attachment of the people will be to the governments of their respective states, wrote James Madison in Federalist 46. The centrality of state and local political concerns in national politics has been one of the American political system's brakes on polarization. The zero-sum forces of two-party competition were moderated by the regional interests of politicians rooted, RST and foremost, in a particular place. Sure, you may be a Republican, and that bill might be pushed by Democrats, but you're a Republican from Oklahoma, damn it, and that bill is good for Oklahoma. Catering to a member of Congress's particularistic interests, either through the direct design of the legislation or through earmarks o'erring unrelated Boehner T.S., gave congressional leaders ways to build coalitions that the logic of partisanship denied. Your party might not want you to vote for that bill, but if you vote for it, your district will get money for a bridge it desperately needs, and putting your name on that bridge is worth more than keeping your co-partisans happy. At least, it was. In his book The Increasingly United States, Daniel Hopkins tracks the troubling nationalization of American politics. At the core of that nationalization is an inversion of the founders' most self-evident assumption, that we will identify more deeply with our home state than with our country. Hopkins traces the change here in a variety of clever ways. He ran a text analysis of digitized books going back to 1800, comparing use of the phrase I am American with I am a Californian/Virginian/New Yorker/etc. Prior to the Civil War, expressions of state identity were far more common than expressions of national identity. National identity took the lead in the run-up to World War I. The two traded places for a while in the early 20th century, and then, around 1968, expressions of national identity raced ahead and never looked back. He shows that when you ask Americans to rank their most important identities in surveys, almost everyone lists nationality in their top three, while the number listing their state, city, or neighborhood lags far behind. He ends that people are likelier to feel insulted when America is being criticized than when their state or city comes in for scorn. He shows that when asked to explain why they are proud of their nation or their state, they routinely express national pride in terms of politically relevant values, while state pride tends to focus on geographic features. I love America because of freedom, I love California because of beaches. If all of this seems obvious, if you take the centrality of national identity for granted, that's the point. What was unimaginable to the founders is self-evident to us. As goes identity, so goes politics. In an analysis of more than 1,600 state party platforms dating back to 1918, Hopkins ends while the platforms in earlier eras focused more on state-specific topics, modern platforms now emphasize whatever topics dominate the national agenda. Similarly, he shows that in 1972, knowing which way a state leaned in presidential politics told one nothing about the likely outcome in the gubernatorial race 15 today, it tells you most of what you need to know. The culprit here is obvious. In recent decades, the media and political environments have both nationalized. Voters following politics today get constant cues to think about national politics, but coverage of state and local politics is declining. For instance, growing up, I read the Los Angeles Times and listened to LA's public radio station, KCRW, which fed me national political stories but also state and local stories. I developed, as a result, a pretty strong identity around California politics, which was less polarized than national politics and focused on very direct questions. What I never did was read the New York Times, because we didn't get it, or listen to national political podcasts, because they didn't exist. If I were growing up outside Los Angeles today, perhaps I'd be reading the newly revitalized LA Times, but it's likelier, as a political junkie, that I'd be reading the New York Times and the Washington Post and Vox, listening to political podcasts, and watching cable news. All of that would be civic-minded and informative, but it would be pounding away at my national political identity and underdeveloping the parts of my political psyche rooted in the place I actually lived. A nationalized media means nationalized political identities. States used to have different political cultures from that of the nation as a whole. That gave members of Congress cross-cutting incentives from what the national parties wanted. Now those incentives are, like so many others, stacked. As Hopkins writes, rather than asking, how will this particular bill affect my district, legislators in a nationalized polity come to ask, is my party for or against this bill? That makes coalition building more difficult, as legislators all evaluate proposed legislation through the same partisan lens. A more nationalized politics is a more polarized politics. Here's an easy way to realize the truth of Hopkins's point: if local interests drove voting patterns, you could predict how a member of Congress would vote on the Affordable Care Act by knowing whether the uninsured rate among his or her constituents was above or below the national average. The ACA was, above all else, a direct subsidy to areas with larger uninsured populations from areas with smaller ones. But how a member of Congress voted on the ACA was almost perfectly predicted by party affiliation, as evidenced by the fact that not a single Senate Republican voted for it and not a single Senate Democrat voted against it. State conditions predicted nothing. A weird thing happened as we nationalized our politics. We became disgusted with the ways that local politics played out nationally. Take earmarks. The small addenda members of Congress would add on to bills to fund a road, a hospital, or a job training bill back home. Earmarks were a way that bipartisan cooperation was, yes, bought. The Congress reporter John Allen described how it worked in a 2015 Vox article. In 2003, I asked Jack Murtha, the Democratic defense appropriator who controlled about $4 billion in earmarks each year, about Tom DeLay, the Republican leader known as the Hammer for his ability to nail down votes. Murtha sat in the far corner of the Democratic side of the House, out of view from the press galleries, and DeLay would sometimes come to visit him before a tight vote. When DeLay needed a few Democrats to secure a win on the OR, Murtha said, he comes over to the corner, and we work it out. Murtha's earmarking power meant that he had a roster of people who owed him favors. For a little more money, he could easily swing a small block of votes to help DeLay pass a bill. Murtha and DeLay didn't agree on much, but earmarks kept them talking, and working with each other. 16 In 2011, Congress got rid of earmarks entirely. They were considered a corrupt, and a corrupting, form of politics. Much better to have Congress run on pure principle and partisanship than the grimy work of negotiating something tangible for your constituents. To ideologues, transactional politics always looks dirty. To the transactional, ideologues look self-destructive. That is, in the end, what happened to Nelson. Rather than being celebrated back home for cutting Nebraska such a sweet deal, conservative media pounced on him. His concession got branded the Cornhusker kickback, and his own governor told him to turn it down. Now it's a matter of principle, Heineman told Politico. The federal government can keep that money. 17 Nelson called him foolish but backed down. The provision was stripped from the bill. Nelson, seeing the writing on the wall, declined to run for re-election in 2012 and was replaced by a Republican. That same year, Heineman cautioned his constituents against accepting the Medicaid expansion they could have had for free. If this unfunded Medicaid expansion is implemented, state aid to education and funding for the University of Nebraska will be cut or taxes will be increased, he warned. 18 More competition, more problems there was, perhaps, another secret to the system's success, one that I didn't appreciate until I read Princeton University political scientist Francis Lee's book Insecure Majorities. American politics, for most of its history, simply wasn't very competitive. And contrary to what the conventional wisdom holds, perhaps that was a good thing, or at least, given the idiosyncrasies of our system, a necessary one. This is not what I learned in civics class. Close competition means voters have real choices, that politicians have accountability, that both sides need to keep public opinion and the common good in mind. Absent real competition, even a well-structured democracy rots into a corrupt autocracy. But here's the thing, Lee says. For most of American history, including the eras of cooperative, far-sighted governance our civics textbooks remember most fondly, American politics wasn't competitive. 19 Writing in 1965, Samuel Lubel said, "Our political solar system has been characterized not by two equally competing suns, but by a sun and a moon." 20 The Republican Party ran American politics for most of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Democrats held the reins in the decades following the Great Depression and World War II. And majorities, both in terms of presidential vote totals and congressional control, were often lopsided. Consider Lee's chart, which combines share of the national two-party presidential vote, share of House seats, and share of Senate seats. The farther the line stretches left, the larger the Democrats' advantage. The farther it plunges right, the stronger the GOP's lock on political power. The durability of party control in America's past is easy to miss because our political histories tend to be presidential histories, and the presidency has tended to be more competitive than control of Congress. But when you view political power through a broader lens, our era is an aberration. In this 150-year time frame, there's no period where political control has been as tenuous as in the last four decades. And that's true whether you're looking at how often control of the government switches or how much power the majority party wields when it's on top. The stability of American politics extended to the media's coverage of American politics. Lee swept the New York Times's archive between 1958 and 2014 and found that before 1982, in only two election years was there speculation in the New York Times about possible shifts in control of Congress. In 2010, by contrast, there were more than 70 such stories. These results likely reflect changing conventions in political reporting. News sections carry more speculation about outcomes in modern times than they did in earlier decades, but the fact remains, a political system in which changes in congressional control are rarer, and are talked about more rarely, is going to be a political system that both is and feels far more stable in its hierarchies. This is key to Lee's point. When one party is perpetually dominant, the subordinate party has reason to cooperate, as that's its only realistic shot at wielding influence. Either you work well with the majority party or you have no say over policy, nothing to bring home to your constituents. You can think of a politician's political priorities as running roughly in this order: 1. Win re-election. 2. Win the majority. 3. Shape governance as much as possible. Governing comes 3rd, not because politicians are cynical, though they often are, but because you can't govern at all if you don't win re-election, and you can't govern effectively from the minority. Even so, if winning the majority becomes impossible, then the priorities look like this: 1. Win re-election. 2. Shape governance as much as possible. Indeed, in this ranking, both priorities work together, because you're likelier to win re-election, at least in past eras in American politics, if you're bringing money home to your district and can brag about bills with your name on them. But for those priorities to work together, you have to cultivate a good relationship with the majority party. You can't be engaged in a constant campaign of obstruction and sabotage. Lee's argument is that close competition, where neither party perceives itself as a permanent majority or permanent minority, breeds all-out partisan combat. When winning the majority becomes possible, the logic of cooperation dissolves. If you're signing on to the majority's bills and boasting about the provisions you added to their legislation, then you're part of their re-election strategy. If you're keeping the majority from passing anything and making sure people are fed up with the state of politics, then the voters are likelier to make a change. This is the paradox of bipartisanship, what Bob Mischel, the leader of the House Republicans in the 1980s, called the subservient, timid mentality of the permanent minority. 21 Makes it easier to work with the majority but harder to win back the majority. Governing and campaigning. Con. Once a political party has decided the path to governing is retaking the majority, not working with the existing majority, the incentives transform. Instead of cultivating a good relationship with your colleagues across the aisle, you need to destroy them, because you need to convince the voters to destroy them, too. Dick Cheney, then a member of the House of Representatives, put it sharply in 1985. Confrontation TSR strategy, he said. Polarization often has very bany chale results. If everything is handled through compromise and conciliation, if there are no real issues dividing us from the Democrats, why should the country change and make us the majority? 22. There's nothing particularly unusual about this. It's the logic of zero-sum contests everywhere. But America's political system is unusual in that it permits divided government and is full of tools minorities can use to obstruct governance. Imagine you work in an OCE where your boss, who you think is a jerk, needs your help to niche his projects. If you help him, he keeps his job and maybe even gets a promotion. If you refuse to help him, you become his boss, and he may get red. Now add in a deep dose of disagreement, you hate his projects, believe them to be bad for the company and even the world, and a bunch of colleagues who also hate your boss and will be mad at you if you help him. Think you'll help him under those conditions? That's basically American politics right now. Bipartisan cooperation is often necessary for governance but irrational for the minority party to OER. It's a haluva way to run a railroad. This bizarre structure worked during much of American history because one party was usually dominant enough to make cooperation worth it for the minority. Lee quotes Theodore Lowe's 1963 analysis, Towards Functionalism in Political Science, where he says that the party system that best TS America's weird political structure is not a competitive two-party system but a system in which the second party is very weak, that is, a modi-ed one-party system. But we've not had that system for almost 40 years now, and there's no obvious way to return to it even if we wanted to. The age of cooperation is over. The disagreements run too deep, the debates are too nationalized, the coalitions are too deranged, the political identities are too powerful. So what's happening now is the norms and understandings that made the informal system work are collapsing, and the underlying, dysfunctional structure is coming clear, with disastrous consequences for day-to-day governance. Take, for instance, the liebuster. Breaking Congress to control it. Here's the thing about the Senate liebuster, it wasn't supposed to exist. Sarah Binder, author, alongside Stephen Smith, of Politics or Principle, filibustering in the United States Senate, dug deep into the rule's origins and found there was no real origin at all. Originally, both the House and the Senate had what's called a previous question motion, which allows a member of the body to move a whatever point is being debated the previous question, in parliamentary parlance, and demand an actual vote. That's the provision the House uses to end discussion even today. The Senate used to have that rule, too. And then it got rid of it, and created the liebuster as an unintended consequence. In 1805, Aaron Burr has just killed Alexander Hamilton, Binder told me. He comes back to the Senate and gives his farewell address. Burr basically says that you are a great body. You are conscientious and wise, you do not give in to the whims of passion. But your rules are a mess. And he goes through the rulebook pointing out duplicates and things that are unclear. 23. This is, it's worth saying, a famous speech. It's recorded that Burr, not always known as a great speaker and fresh from murdering another major politician in a duel, literally brought members of the Senate to tears in the delivery. It's easy to inspire when you're telling people how great they are and how magnificent their legacies will be when given history's due consideration. One of Burr's suggestions was to cut the previous question motion, so they did, apparently without realizing that they just made it impossible to cut a debate. We say the Senate developed the liebuster to protect minorities and the right to debate, says Binder. That's hogwash. It's a mistake. Believe me, I would have loved to end the smoking gun where the Senate decides to create a deliberative body. But it takes years before anyone gurs out that the liebuster has just been created. The liebuster then was not like the liebuster now. Today, the liebuster can be shut down with 60 votes, a process known as cloture. Then, the liebuster was unstoppable so long as a senator or group of senators was willing to hold the oar. You could have every member of the body but one desperate to take a vote and there wasn't a damn thing they could do about it. As such, past Liebusters were a war of physical endurance and tactical gamesmanship. In 1908, for instance, Senator Thomas Gore was liebustering a currency bill, with the support of his compatriot Senator William Stone. Gore tried to yield the over to Stone. But Gore, who was blind, didn't realize Stone had stepped out of the chamber. The majority did, and they used the mistake to take back the over and call the vote .24 brutal. It wasn't until 1917, when a group of senators liebustered President Woodrow Wilson's bill to arm American merchant ships against German submarines for 23 days, that Wilson, a trained political scientist with strong views about proper parliamentary procedure, convinced the Senate to adopt a cloture rule allowing liebusters to be broken by a two-thirds majority of the body. And it wasn't until 1975 that the threshold was lowered to its current 3 FTHS level. Given the way today's weakened liebuster paralyzes the U.S. Senate, how did the body survive, and even thrive, in this long era of unbreakable liebusters? The answer is that though the rules made the liebuster far more powerful for most of American history, the norms made it weaker. The liebuster was barely used. Just because a senator, a group of senators, or a party full of senators could liebuster didn't mean they would. After all, if everyone was liebustering all the time, how would the Senate ever get anything done? My favorite example of this comes from a letter written by President Lyndon Johnson's Senate liaison, Mike Manatos, after the 1964 election, assessing how the results changed Medicare's chances of passage. After ticking through the winners and losers, Manatos concluded, "If all our supporters are present and voting, we would win by a vote of 55-45-25. Imagine that." In living memory, the Senate could consider a bill as consequential as Medicare without anyone expecting a liebuster. The liebuster rule is used to make more obscure mischief, too. A cloture vote isn't costless, it carries at least 30 hours of additional debate, which means that even if the minority knows it will lose, it can still use cloture votes to slow the majority down, tie up the Senate over, and keep other business from getting done. There are examples of judicial nominees being liebustered only to subsequently pass unanimously. In 2009, then-Senator Tom Harkin, a Democrat from Iowa, told me about a particularly egregious example, coming as it did deep in the throes of the financial crisis. "We had an extension on unemployment insurance," Harkin said. "We had a liebuster that lasted over 3 weeks. They held up everything. And in the end, the vote was 97-1. 26 filibustering isn't a way lone senators make an unpopular argument heard, but a way the minority party in the U.S. Senate sabotages the majority's ability to govern, in the hopes that voters will punish the party that seems to be in charge. Filibusters were rare in past Senates, with one gruesome exception: they were used routinely to block anti-lynching and civil rights legislation. According to OCHAL records, from 1917 to 1970, the Senate took 49 votes to break liebusters. That's an average of slightly less than one each year. From 2013 to 2014, it had to take 218. That might have been a high mark of Senate obstruction, but there was no subsequent retreat to the rare liebusters of yesteryear. The 2015-2016 Senate session saw 123 cloture votes, and the 2017-2018 session hosted 168. This is exactly what Lindsay's and Lee's research would predict. Back when American politics was less competitive and less polarized, liebusters were rare. They were rare in part because the parties were ideologically diverse, which prevented the internal agreement that leads to coordinated and strategic obstruction, and in part because the minority party saw little chance of regaining power, which left it cautious about antagonizing the majority. But now that the disagreements between the parties run deep and control of the Senate teeters on a knife's edge, the liebuster is a constant. This is American politics shifting to align with the more confrontational, zero-sum strategies the formal rules would suggest, rather than the more cooperative, tolerant approaches the informal norms encouraged. Another good example of this dynamic is the debt ceiling, perhaps the strangest, most dangerous booby trap in American policy making. The way it works is this: Congress and the President routinely make spending decisions that carry, as a predictable consequence, additional federal borrowing. But rather than authorizing that borrowing when the spending decision is made, Congress holds separate votes, at separate times, permitting the federal government to borrow the money necessary to keep paying its bills. This might seem like a small bit of dysfunction, but it's actually a bomb resting in the center of the global financial system. U.S. Treasury bonds are considered the safest asset on the planet. They're held in massive numbers by governments, pension funds, hedge funds, investment banks, even ordinary investors, and they always play the same purpose, a riskless asset, the one financial product you can always count on to pay off. As such, much of the rest of the financial system is built on top of U.S. Treasury bonds. The interest rate they pay is called the riskless rate of return, and other products, from mortgages to auto loans, use it as their benchmark and then add the risk they calculate in their loans on top of it. A simple definition of financial crises is that they occur when an important class of assets that people think is worth X actually proves to be worth something very different from X, and the market realizes that prices are wrong all throughout the system. Markets are built on information, and if the core information collapses into chaos all at once, the results can be catastrophic. That's roughly what happened in 2008, when the subprime mortgage bonds that the markets thought to be low risk turned out to be high risk, and credit markets convulsed in the aftermath. If the U.S. government failed to pass a debt ceiling increase and thus stopped paying its debts, the markets would have to re-evaluate the most core piece of financial information of them all. The result would be a global financial crisis, sparked by congressional inkting. Debt ceiling bills have always been used to embarrass the other side, but they've never been used as actual leverage because the consequences were simply too dire. That changed in 2011, when the newly elected Tea Party class of Republicans refused to increase the debt ceiling in order to increase their leverage to force spending cuts, a bit of anti-CIT dogmatism that tellingly evaporated the moment a Republican won the White House. The resulting crisis shook financial markets and led the Standard & Poor's credit agency to downgrade U.S. government debt. Congressional Republicans weren't wrong that the debt ceiling gave them power to demand concessions. Congress could have simply chosen to tie borrowing and spending decisions together, so there was never the possibility of legislators forcing a default. Instead, they left it hanging out there, a cocked gun that reckless legislators could use to hold their own country hostage unless they got what they want. That had never been done before because that just wasn't how things were done in American politics. Now it is. You see these dynamics everywhere in the American political system now. Norms of cooperation and deference are breaking down and crises, paralysis, and polarization are the result. Shutdowns have become more common. Judicial nominations have stopped relying on home state senators' consent, rules have evolved to limit amendment processes and committee debate. This is all rational and maybe even inevitable. Why shouldn't both sides use and, when possible, change the rules to maximize their advantage? The problem is that we have a political system where the rules create irresolvable conflict, gridlock, and even global financial crises. This is dangerous, Senator Michael Bennett, a Colorado Democrat known for his bipartisan bent, told me. We are a democratic republic. If we can't make decisions because of structural issues in our political system, or because of a habit of mind that doesn't allow us to believe other people deserve to be on the playing field, we cannot govern ourselves. That is an existential threat to the next generation of Americans. 27 Chapter 9 The Difference Between Democrats and Republicans. When I moved to Washington, in 2005, Thomas Mann and Norm Ornstein had risen to the most raried heights in political journalism. They had become clichés. Mann and Ornstein, the co-authors, were always referred to as a duo, like Sonny and Cher had been the Beltway's go-to experts on Congress for a generation. They knew everything, talked to everyone, were everywhere. They became so ubiquitous that I knew of publications barring reporters from quoting the two scholars just to get some new voices into their stories. A key reason for the duo's preeminence is they were relentlessly, ostentatiously balanced. Mann made his home at the center-left Brookings Institution. Ornstein hung his hat at the more forthrightly conservative American Enterprise Institute. Thus, in addition to their deep knowledge of Congress and their talent for airing the perfect quote on deadline, they embodied a fundamental assumption of American politics: the two parties were ideologically opposed but otherwise equivalent. Their presence in an article was a meta-message about non-partisanship. But Mann and Ornstein grew queasy. They might have been balanced, but the political system they were paid to understand had grown imbalanced. Worse, they believed the media's fetishization of the very thing they represented was obscuring the truth of American politics. So Mann and Ornstein decided to speak it themselves. Few acts of political analysis are truly courageous, but this one was. Mann and Ornstein spent a lifetime of accumulated political capital, detonating a carefully constructed brand, to try to force a reckoning with what the Republican Party had become and the role the media had played. In 2012, the two scholars published It's Even Worse Than It Looks, and in it, they minced no words: today's Republican Party is an insurgent outlier. It has become ideologically extreme, contemptuous of the inherited social and economic policy regime, scornful of compromise, unpersuaded by conventional understanding of facts, evidence, and science, and dismissive of the legitimacy of its political opposition, all but declaring war on the government. The Democratic Party, while no paragon of civic virtue, is more ideologically centered and diverse, protective of the government's role as it developed over the course of the last century, open to incremental changes in policy fashioned through bargaining with the Republicans, and less disposed to or adept at take-no-prisoners conflict between the parties. This asymmetry between the parties, which journalists and scholars often brush aside or whitewash in a quest for balance, constitutes a huge obstacle to effective governance. Point one: Mann and Ornstein's diagnosis was controversial at the time, and the scholars found themselves disinvited from the Sunday shows that used to book them so regularly, ignored by the reporters who used to call them so eagerly. Liberals loved their book, of course, but now the media saw quoting Mann and Ornstein as signaling something entirely different. They had gone from representing the cherished assumption of party equivalence to representing the controversial rejection of it. A few years later, Trump emerged like a golem summoned by Mann and Ornstein's words. He was their description of the GOP given a shock of orange hair, a cardiovascular system, and a Twitter account. In August 2015, when a Trump nomination, to say nothing of a Trump presidency, still sounded like a ridiculous prediction, Ornstein argued in The Atlantic that Trump really could win, that his candidacy and its triumph was predicted by a cycle of radicalization that was ousting the Republican Party at every level. I have seen a GOP Congress in which the establishment, itself very conservative, has lost the battle to co-opt the Tea Party radicals, and itself has been largely co-opted or, at minimum, cowed by them. As the Congressional Party has transformed, so has the activist component of the party outside Washington. In state legislatures, state party apparatuses, and state party platforms, there are regular statements or positions that make the most extreme lawmakers in Washington seem mild. Egged on by talk radio, cable news, right-wing blogs, and social media, the activist voters who make up the primary and caucus electorates have become angrier and angrier, not just at the Kenyan socialist president but also at their own leaders. Point two: most observers saw Trump as a radical break from the Republican Party's traditions and narratives. Ornstein saw him as the logical next step for a party that was transforming itself, its institutions, and its leadership into vessels of revanchist rage. Conservatives were choosing, again and again, the path of maximum confrontation and disruption, rallying behind the voices that promised to go where their predecessors hadn't, to speak the words that had previously been whispered, to embrace the tactics that had once been shunned. Trump wasn't a break with this Republican Party. He was the most authentic expression of its modern psychology. The primary would prove Ornstein right. This is not a story you can tell about the Democratic Party, which, though it has moved ideologically left, has remained tethered to traditional institutions and behaviors. You can get way in the weeds of the data showing congressional Republicans have moved further left than Democrats have moved right, believe me, I have, but the simple fact is that Republicans nominated Donald Trump in 2016 and Democrats nominated Hillary Clinton. That is to say, One party nominated a candidate contemptuous of established norms, obsessed with locking up political opponents, and possessed by conspiracy theories. The other party didn't. Nor was the presidency a 1-0. Between 2012 and 2018, House Republicans drove John Boehner from the speakership for being insouciantly radical and then made Paul Ryan's life so miserable he resigned the post after only 3 years. By contrast, as of 2019, House Democrats were led by the same leadership team they elected in 2006. During Bill Clinton's administration, Republicans pursued an unpopular and bizarre impeachment campaign. During Barack Obama's presidency, Republicans nearly breached the debt ceiling, almost causing another global financial crisis, in an attempt to bring the Democrat to heel. During both presidencies, Republicans repeatedly shut down the federal government. In all these cases, top Republicans expressed unease with the path they had chosen but seemed helpless to do anything but channel the fury of their base. For all the rage Democrats felt toward George W. Bush in 2006 and Donald Trump in 2018, they have not attempted to gain leverage by endangering the global financial system. When Democrats took the House in 2006, Pelosi resisted calls to defund the Iraq War. Weirdly and tellingly, the longest government shutdown of the Trump era began when Republicans held Congress and Trump himself forced a shutdown over a Republican spending compromise that didn't fund his wall. Make no mistake, plenty of liberals will read this capsule history as a recounting of Democratic weakness. The difference here is not that liberal activists haven't wanted the Democratic Party to escalate its tactics in opposition, it's that elected Democrats have largely been able to resist their demands. The polarizing forces I have described throughout this book are acting on both coalitions. So why has the Democratic Party weathered them in a way the Republican Party hasn't? Why are the two parties so different? The answer is twofold: Democrats have an immune system of diversity and democracy. The Republican Party doesn't. This has not left the Democrats unaffected by the forces of polarization, to be sure. But if polarization has given the Democratic Party the Republican Party has caught pneumonia. The benefits of diversity early in the 2020 Democratic primary, an interesting thing began happening. The Democratic candidates began getting asked about reparations for slavery. A few of them, notably Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren, expressed support. But instead of proposing direct compensation to the descendants of slaves, it turned out the Democrats were pitching policies for, well, everybody. Harris has proposed monthly payments to qualified citizens of any race in the form of a tax credit, reported the Associated Press in February 2019. Warren has called for universal child care that would guarantee the BANI from birth until a child enters school. These were universalist programs that would help people of all races being pitched in particularist ways. Point 3: as an act of politics, it was a bizarre, worst of both worlds compromise. It risks prompting both withering criticism from Republicans and a shrug from black voters and activists if the proposals are seen as an empty gesture that simply renames existing policy ideas as reparations, wrote the AP. Why take a broadly popular policy, like Harris's idea to expand the earned income tax credit, and tie it to a divisive idea like reparations? The reason gets to a deep and underappreciated difference between the parties. Back in Chapter 2, we discussed the ways the two coalitions have sorted by ideology, race, religion, geography, and psychology. But not all sorting is the same. Sorting has made Democrats more diverse and Republicans more homogeneous. This is often seen as a weakness for Democrats. They're a collection of interest groups, a party of list makers, an endless roll call. But it's played a crucial role in moderating the party's response to polarization. Republicans are overwhelmingly dependent on white voters. Democrats are a coalition of liberal whites, African Americans, Hispanics, and Asians. Republicans are overwhelmingly dependent on Christians. Democrats are a coalition of liberal and non-white Christians, Jews, Muslims, New Agers, atheists, Buddhists, and so on. On the XED versus UID psychological dimensions discussed earlier, Republicans are overwhelmingly the party of XED voters. But as Hetherington and Wyler note in their book Prius or Pickup, Democrats are psychologically sorted only among white voters. Communities of color include lots of people who value traditional family hierarchies and top-down authority, they write. In fact, African Americans are the group most likely to have members with XED worldviews for, but the Republican Party has so repelled non-white voters that they tend to be Democrats no matter their psychological makeup. When we talk about sorting, it can sound symmetrical. Republicans have become the party of white voters, Democrats the party of non-white voters. But those are two very different party structures. Sorting has made the Democrats into a coalition of adherents and driven Republicans further into sameness. As a result, appealing to Democrats requires appealing to a lot of different kinds of people with different interests. It means winning liberal whites in New Hampshire and traditionalist blacks in South Carolina. It means talking to Irish Catholics in Boston and the karmically curious in California. Democrats need to go broad to win over their party and, as we'll see, they need to reach into right-leaning territory to win power. Republicans can afford to go deep. You can see this in the polling. The percentage of Americans calling themselves conservative has long dwarfed the percentage who identify as liberal. In 1994, conservatives outnumbered liberals 38-17. That gap has closed in recent years, but as of January 2019, conservatives still lead, 35-26. Three-quarters of Republicans identify as conservative, while only half of Democrats call themselves liberals, and for Democrats, that's a historic high point. Self-identified moderates outnumbered liberals in the Democratic Party until 2008.5. What that means is Republicans have been able to appeal to their party through ideology. Democrats haven't. They've had to appease a coalition of whites and non-whites, liberals and moderates, the XED and the UID. They've done that by promising different policies to different groups, so airing a transactionalist, more than ideological, approach to party building. In their book Asymmetric Politics, Ideological Republicans and Group Interest Democrats, Matt Grossman and David Hopkins OER the most careful study yet of the differences between the Republican and Democratic coalitions. What they end is that the Democratic Party is a diverse collection of interest groups held together by policy goals, while the Republican Party is built atop a more united base that ends commonality in more abstract, ideological commitments. 6. Grossman and Hopkins show this difference in a variety of ways. More than twice as many interest groups make endorsements in Democratic primaries as Republican primaries. In an analysis of presidential debates from 1996 to 2012, Republican presidential candidates were more than twice as likely as Democrats to mention ideology or principles, while Democrats cited social, demographic, and interest groups at markedly higher rates than Republicans and talked more about new policy proposals. In poll after poll, and under both Democratic and Republican presidents, Democrats say they prefer politicians who compromise to get things done, while Republicans say they prefer politicians who stick to their positions. IDER with Grossman and Hopkins on a key point. I think they mistake an identitarian movement for an ideological movement. If conservatives believed what they claim to believe about executive power, limited government, and congressional primacy, they would have seen Trump's presidency as a crisis. And for some, it was. George Will, the longtime columnist at The Washington Post, left the Republican Party. Representative Mark Sanford, the rock-ribbed conservative from South Carolina, refused to hold his tongue and lost to a primary challenger. Representative Justin Amash, the libertarian Republican from Michigan, called for impeachment proceedings against Trump and renounced his party membership. But for most conservatives, whether they were prominent pundits or everyday voters, there proved to be no contradiction between conservatism and Trumpism. Quite the opposite, actually. According to a September 2019 Gallup poll, 75% of self-identified conservatives and 91% of self-identified conservative Republicans approved of the job Trump was doing. 7. This is because conservatism isn't, for most people, an ideology. It's a group identity. A clever 2018 paper by political scientists Michael Barber and Jeremy Pope tested this experimentally. Trump was constantly adopting contradictory positions on issues, and his reputation for saying and doing anything primed voters to believe he really had said whatever they were told he'd said. There has never been a president, or any party leader, who shifts back and forth so often between liberal and conservative issue positions, they wrote, and that opened space for a revealing study. Point 8. Here's how it worked. Barber and Pope asked voters if they agreed or disagreed with DeArendt policies. Because of the exibility of Trump's rhetoric, they were able to pick policies where Trump had, at some point, articulated both a liberal policy position and a conservative policy position. They then split their sample into four groups: a control group, a group that got asked about their policy views without any Trump-related information, and then groups that were asked about policy and given either Trump's liberal views or his conservative ones. If conservatism was an ideology first and foremost, then a stronger attachment to that ideology should provide a stronger mooring against the whines of Trump. Instead, the precise opposite was true. The people who identified as most strongly conservative were the likeliest to move in response to Trump. And the EECT was about the same size whether Trump was taking the conservative or liberal position. It was the direction of Trump, not the direction of the policy, that mattered. Interestingly, there wasn't an equal and opposite reaction among strong liberals. They didn't change position much to oppose Trump. This is what Trump understood about conservatives that so many of his critics missed. They were an identity group under threat, and so long as you promised them protection and victories, they would follow you to hell and back. Amish, in an interview conducted with Vox's Jane Costin days before leaving the GOP, put it well. A lot of Trump Republicans have this mindset that they have to ghost this all-out war against the left. And if they have to use big government to do it, they're perfectly any with that. So when I go to Twitter and talk about overspending or the size of the government, I get a lot of reactions now from Trump supporters saying, who cares how big the government is, or who cares how much we're spending as long as we're acting against illegal immigration and pushing back against the left. 9. The Fox News effect. Crucially, the Democratic Party isn't just more diverse in terms of its members, it's also more diverse in its trusted information sources. In 2014, the Pew Research Center conducted a survey measuring trust in DeArendt media sources, giving respondents 36 DeArendt outlets to consider and asking them to rate their trust in each. Respondents who counted as consistent liberals trusted a wide variety of media outlets ranging from center-right to left: ABC, Al Jazeera America, the BBC, Bloomberg, CBS, CNN, The Colbert Report, Daily Kos, The Daily Show, The Economist, The Ed Schultz Show, Google News, The Guardian, The Huffington Post, Mother Jones, MSNBC, NBC, The New Yorker, The New York Times, NPR, PBS, Politico, Slate, USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, and Yahoo. Consistent conservatives did not. Of the 36 outlets named, only a handful of deeply ideological sources commanded more trust than distrust among respondents who counted as consistently conservative: Fox News, Breitbart, The Wall Street Journal, The Blaze, The Drudge Report, The Sean Hannity Show, The Glenn Beck Program, and The Rush Limbaugh Show. Pew also asked consistent liberals and conservatives which outlet served as their main news source. Here, too, the difference was stark. For the liberals, there was no dominant news source. CNN was the top choice with 15%, followed by NPR with 13%, MSNBC with 12%, and the New York Times with 10%. Among consistent conservatives, 47% chose Fox News, with the next most popular answer being local news, at 11%. 2 years later, Pew commissioned a similar survey during the 2016 election, measuring where Clinton and Trump voters were getting their news. Among Clinton voters, the most popular choice was CNN, with 18% naming it as their main news source, followed by MSNBC, which was the top choice of 9%. Among Trump voters, 40% named Fox News. 10. The Pew endings mirror what other researchers have discovered. In partisanship, propaganda, and disinformation, online media and the 2016 U.S. presidential election, a study of media dynamics in the 2016 election, six Harvard researchers concluded, the leading media on the right and left are rooted in deterrent traditions and journalistic practices. On the conservative side, more attention was paid to pro-Trump, highly partisan media outlets. On the liberal side, by contrast, the center of gravity was made up largely of long-standing media organizations steeped in the traditions and practices of objective journalism. 11. Political parties exist within informational ecosystems. Those ecosystems create the context in which voters make demands, in which politicians make strategic choices, in which presidential aspirants craft messages. The Democratic Party's informational ecosystem combines mainstream sources that seek objectivity, liberal sources that push partiality, and even some center-right sources with excellent reputations, like The Economist and the news reporting in the Wall Street Journal. On any given question, liberals trust in sources that pull them left and sources that pull them toward the center, in sources oriented toward escalation and sources oriented toward moderation, in sources that root their identity in a political movement and sources that carefully tend a reputation for being antagonistic toward political movements. There is no similar diversity in the GOP's trusted informational ecosystem, which is entirely built around conservative news sources, many of them propagandistic. Conservatives protest that the media is liberally biased, so they had no choice but to build their alternative network. In my experience, it's true that reporters for mainstream outlets are culturally liberal in their personal politics, though more mixed in their economic and foreign policy views. The newsrooms I know are overwhelmingly pro-choice, but they're also biased toward DCIT hawkery and the national security establishment. The dominant ideology, to the extent there is one, tracks Morning Joe, not the nation. That said, mainstream newsrooms are built around incentives that are deterrent from, and often contrary to, liberalism as a political movement. The New York Times and ABC News fear a liberal reputation. They want to be understood as neutral arbiters of truth, and reporting oppositionally and inconveniently on the Democratic Party is both part of the self-identity and the business model. Perhaps as important, the intermixing of mainstream and left news sources forces an adherence to professional journalistic practices. MSNBC's reporters and primetime hosts want to be respected by the Washington Post's reporters. Slate's writers want to do work that will get them hired by the New York Times. As such, the business models and reputational ambitions of the mainstream outlets don't just discipline their work, they also discipline the work of the more liberal outlets that admire them. Conversely, Breitbart, Limbaugh, and The Blaze are operating in a self-contained conservative ecosystem, where part of the appeal is outright hostility to mainstream institutions. Over and over again, you see conservative media working to discredit other forms of media and even other forms of information. Fox News's tagline, "Fair and Balanced," is an insinuation that the rest of the media is unfair and biased. Limbaugh goes even further than that. He calls the media, the scientific community, academia, and the government the four corners of deceit and tells his listeners, "We live in two universes. One universe is a lie. One universe is an entire lie. Everything run, dominated, and controlled by the left here and around the world is a lie. The other universe is where we are, and that's where reality reigns supreme and we deal with it. And seldom do these two universes ever overlap." 12. The conservative movement has spent years battling liberal bias in the media and the academia. Some of their complaints had merit. But rather than reform those institutions or build similarly credible competitors, the right has untethered itself from them and built an informational ecosystem premised on purity rather than process. In their essay How Information Became Ideological, Grossman and Hopkins describe the result. Only the Republican Party has actively opposed society's central information gathering and disseminating institutions, universities and the news media, while Democrats have remained reliant on those institutions to justify policy choices and engage in political debate, considering them both independent arbiters and allies. Although each party's elites, activists, and voters now depend on different sources of knowledge and selectively interpret the messages they receive, the source of this information polarization is the American conservative movement's decades-long battle against institutions that it has deemed irredeemably liberal. 13. In an essay for Vox, Dave Roberts calls this tribal epistemology when information is evaluated based not on conformity to common standards of evidence or correspondence to a common understanding of the world, but on whether it supports the tribe's values and goals and is vouchsafed.